This is the Meat Eater Podcast coming at you shirtless, severely bug bitten, and in my case, underwearless.
We hunt the Meat Eater Podcast.
You can't predict anything.
Hey, everyone. First thing I want to talk about, how annoying it is. Like, I don't understand people who don't want to, guys who like to hunt, who act like they don't want to hunt turkeys. You hear it so much.
You just have that happen to you?
Yeah, Annie Racer. Oh, yeah, I just don't get it. I hear that from so many people.
But that doesn't count as
I run around my house going, yeah, man, it's spring thunder, dude.
It's mini elk hunting.
Oh, my God.
Just locate them.
What? It's like, I don't understand, like, what's not like? Big old damn bird coming through the woods, his head changing colors.
Right.
I mean,
you know why? Because I think when most people think hunting turkey, they're not thinking hunting wild turkey. They're thinking like, I'm hunting butterball and cartoon turkey and whatever the turkey is that's in their head.
Or the turkey that, like, is in their, like, they go to their mother-in-law's house, you know, in some suburb in New Jersey, and there's a turkey in the yard, and they think that's what turkeys are like.
It's hard to give the turkey respect until you've been schooled by the turkey a few times.
Multiple times.
Oh, I get sick of hearing about that from people, man. It's like one of the most hunted critters on the planet. Not on the planet. It's one of the most hunted critters in the country if you look at man hours. The most shot animal in the country is mourning doves. Numbers. Yep. Man hours, I think man hours is deer. Pure numbers is doves. Man hours is deer. I think turkey's up there, though.
The old squirrel's got to rank high, too,
yeah.
I would think.
Yeah. But think about doves, dude. You go out and, you know, like we went dove hunting this year. A couple hours into it, you got 60 doves laying there with a bunch of guys, you know. So, yeah, it's the most harvested critter. We're here with, how do you like to describe yourself, Jason? Call maker. Jason Phelps. Quality game calls. This guy, what's interesting about this guy is he actually is out in his garage. He makes the calls. I mean, from scratch, out in his garage, right?
Yeah, literally. I mean, besides the laminate coming to me pre-pressed, you know, basically I get a big sheet of plywood and that's what I start with on the wood calls. And, you know, the diaphragm start is a piece of scrap latex, a piece of tape, and a aluminum frame, you know, and everything's hand built. So far, I've been able to keep up with the man, but everything's hand built.
And you're a real pain in the ass about getting American made stuff.
Pretty much. I mean, very, very, the green bands on some of these calls are made in like Indonesia, but that's about as, you know, I've really tried, you know, the whole bleed red, white, and blue thing. I'm pretty proud American. I've really tried to source all my plastic, you know, in the U.S. and work with companies that, you know, are able to source everything in the U.S. So,
well, why did you ever get interested in making game calls?
Okay, here's I'll keep the story short, but there was a small local sporting goods show there in my hometown, real small.
Explain where that is.
Menlo, Washington. I think it was the Pacific County Outdoor Show.
Yeah, we're recording right now in Seattle, Washington.
So
in my brand spiggity new garage, and Jason's—he's you're from 2 hours south of Seattle.
Yeah, down PL Washington's actually where I live, but just outside of Centralia-Chehalis area.
And you come from a long line of loggers.
Yeah. Everybody in my family.
That business is booming.
It is. It's still going good down there.
Is it really? I was joking because I thought I was like,
no, it's still. I mean, they work for warehouses, which is one of the last.
So they're doing pulp and stuff, though, right?
Yeah, export. Yeah. Warehouser does a lot of export, but, you know, get too deep into it. You know, they're on, you know, a 35 to 40 year cycle. So a lot of it, you know, they aren't getting the export and stuff anymore. But yeah, there's, you know, a lot of them still make a living out there. You know, my hometown's pretty much loaded with loggers, you know, that work out of the Warehouser PL camp.
Gotcha. But then you, like, peeled off, didn't
My old man, he's like, I don't know if it's because he was afraid I wasn't going to cut it and so it was going to hurt his pride or what, but he's like, yeah, you need to go off and go to school. And so I ended up pretty good at math, so I, you know, naturally went the engineering route.
Got a master's master's in game calls.
Yeah. And then you know, always had a passion growing up, ever since my first elk calling. It was, you know, the switch was flipped, and I've been hooked ever since.
So, yeah, getting into it, you obviously started out like liking making game, making yep. animal noises.
Yep. Yeah. It started off with the Primos Thunder Bugle or the Terminator Bugle. I called my first bull and I'm like, man, how can I incorporate this in, to my livelihood or to my passion? And
how old were you then?
Did it started at 7 years ago? So I was 25. Just had my first kid, and it was shortly after that I started up the game calls.
No. How old were you when you got it? How old were you when you blew your first game call?
I bought my first elk call in 98, so I would have been 16, 17. Okay. It was the night before our archery opener here in Western Washington, and we were out just scouting for muzzleloader and rifle. And we actually pulled up to a landing, and the elk scattered, seeing us pull up. I'm like, that's weird.
You pull up to a landing like in a boat?
No, a landing where they log from. So you say,
yeah.
So we pulled up on the landing, and the elk scatter, and I didn't know what I was doing. Get out and rip a bugle, and all of a sudden you hear a bugle down the timber where they just ran from. And, before probably 10 minutes, we had a bull 30 yards in front of us just going nuts, pissing all over himself. And man, this is easy. Bow season starts tomorrow. None of us have bow tags. We're all rifle or muzzleloader hunters. And I didn't hunt archery that year. And then so in my junior year in high school, I got a bow out of the Cabela's catalog. I remember like a mail order bow. Don't go to your local pro shop, get fitted, none of that. Just mom and dad, buy this.
Check out what you left-handed or right-handed.
Yeah. have no clue on draw length or any of that stuff, because at that time, nobody around us bow hunted. Mail order a bow right out of Cabela's.
Wow, and just that long ago, late 90s, there's nobody bow hunting.
No, not in our area. It's taken a huge exponential, it's grown exponentially since probably the 2000s. But at that time, it was pretty much you had any elk you wanted to yourself.
Really?
Yeah, you could go out. I mean,
why is that?
There were very few. I mean, a couple local guys I knew that bow hunted, some old timers that had, grown up doing it their whole lives, but there was nobody compared to what there is now out there.
Huh.
Yeah, I don't know.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was, everybody was a muzzleloader or a rifle hunter out there. It went out the next day, opening day of archery elk, and it still may be my biggest true Roosevelt I've ever called in, a big 6x7, 40 yards. I'm like, all right, that's within 12 hours.
Oh, really?
Yeah, within 12 hours I've called in, two of the biggest Roosevelts I've ever seen during rifle or muzzleloader season. And,
did you kill it?
No, I still wasn't bow hunting yet. I was still just dinking off calling
out. It was bow season. You called a bull in bow season
without a bow. Close. Ton of shot opportunities. Yeah.
But why didn't you go get a dude with a bow?
We tried. My dad
like run an ad in Craigslist. Dude with bow.
But the thing, you couldn't barely find anybody back then. That would have been a tough chore to find somebody with a bow tag.
You're kidding me.
No, it was, and then of course it took off. But then next year I bought a bow and I think I missed 6 bulls. I thought it was going to be easy. So I go out there and, I didn't have the whole, nerves under control yet.
That's a cost. You, man.
Yeah. So 6 bulls, I think I flung arrows over. And then finally the 7th one, I had somehow settled all the nerves and made it count.
We were talking about this the other night. It's like, buddy of mine was talking about how he's got so many friends that can shoot on paper so much better than he can. He's like, they just know more about the gear. They can shoot better than me. They can talk circles around me. They ask me questions I don't know the answer to, but you put them in front of an elk, they can't hit it.
Yep.
He goes, you put me in front of the elk, I just hit it. But it's psychological, man.
Yeah. They're guys that have ice flowing through their veins for sure.
Yeah. But you got to beat that out of yourself too, I think,
Yeah.
I think you just got, like, some people just have a certain number of misses laid up in them,
Yeah. And then, of course, didn't put a whole lot of practice in, being a converted rifle hunter is like, you pick your bow up, sight your 20 through 40 yard pin in and go out. And, I quickly learned that, the dedication to the archery trade and, it required a lot more than going and sighting your rifle in, a week before season. It required, kind of a year-round commitment, and so dialed all that in. But
I would think of hunting as a discipline, but like, but it's not. You don't even need to think about like archery. It has to be a discipline.
Yep.
Anyone that's good at it, unless you just got like the ice, like you're saying. Not only do you need ice flowing through your veins, but you need just like another use of the word discipline, just like the kind of discipline to know when and you have a shot and when you don't have a shot. So if you can do that, if you can go out in the woods and be like, hey, I'll shoot 30 yards or I don't shoot, you know? And guys that are able to stick to that and let a bull walk that's 35, 40 yards away because they drew in their line, like, that's my thing, man. You give me a bull at 30 yards, I'm going to put it right in the heart or I'm not going to shoot. But you wind up shooting and then later being like, pace it off. You had no idea where the thing was. You know what I mean?
Yep.
It's just hard. Yeah. I don't even miss it that. I used to like to bow hunt a lot. And I don't know. I tried to give Yanni a minute ago. I tried to give Yanni a piece of archery equipment. He told me he don't bow hunt anymore.
I honestly think it's easier than rifle hunting now.
Well, yeah. But in that you're not dealing with hordes of dudes.
Yeah. Or just, I mean, say the same area I could hunt area A, bow season and hunt rifle season, whatever seasons they give me. I'd rather have a bugling bull and take those odds versus a rifle and have the extended range, but not necessarily be able to know where they're at or dial them in or, you know, so I honestly think from a success standpoint, I'd rather pick up a bow.
Yeah. I think if God came down and put a gun to my head and said, you got to get an elk this year or I'm going to pull the trigger. And I had to pick, I could do like rifle, especially in Montana, because I did so much of my bow hunting there. But when I would do it, I'd be like, okay, so I got a 6-week archery season, you know, and can pretty much hunt by myself. I would probably go that route.
Yep.
Knowing that just the pressure aspect of it. Because like bow hunting, you can go find an elk and there's a reasonable assumption he's going to be there tomorrow if you leave him unmolested. Rifle season? Dude.
Yeah, who's going to run into him?
Yeah, before? Who knows, man. So anyhow, you were out there, little kid, calling a bull.
Was hooked.
A teenager.
And then,
So do you have a story where you're like, yeah, my call failed me and I knew that I had to make my own?
No, there was a time where the current call company I was using, there were some quality control issues and I was like, man, I got a, my call that was money, everyone I'd buy, and now all of a sudden, one out of four, one out of five is good. And I'm like, what the, what's going on? And that kind of led to it, but the real reason, and it's kind of a strange reason to ever start a business, is I was at that sportsman show, walking through, and there was an old man in the corner, had an old lathe, and was actually turning calls at the show, and it was my girlfriend at the time, wife now, and just kind of watching him. I was like, I can do that,
You're like, hey, baby.
Yeah.
I can do that.
Yeah, you think that guy's sexy because he's turning calls over there? And, no, I was like, being a semi-redneck growing up in a small town, like, I can work a lathe, have wood shop in school. I can do all that. And it was kind of, so I was able to kind of tie my passion into, that kind of lit the spark. This guy was sitting there making calls, and they didn't sound very good. I'm like, why? Let's sit and play around and see what we can do, make one sound good, and then we'll kind of do a slow release. I thought when I started making this, it all started with the wood elk call. That was the very first call I made. And
what do you call that one?
The Easy Estrus.
Easy Estrus.
Yeah, just a, I got on a lot of at the time there was some, three or four custom call forums, where the custom call makers were on there, talking about woods they were using and styles and finishes. And so I was just, soaking it all in as much as I can learn, what wood goes with what finish and, what acoustic properties do you get out of certain densities. And so I was soaking it all in. And, I actually traded my first muzzleloader bullhorns for a lathe from another local call maker down there. I'm like, I sent him three maple burls that my uncle had cut as a timber faller. And I traded a set of my horns cause he makes calls out of the actual horn.
Oh, is that right?
So I traded. I'm like, man, it's to me, they're just sitting in the garage collecting dust, but it had some sentimental value. But I'm like, this is, just had a kid, I'm like, this is my entry in. So he traded me a lathe, for that three burls. And
so how old were you then?
25.
You had kids a little bit young, not young by modern standards.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, as I was 25, had the kid was like 3 months old, I think, when I kind of started and got the lathe and ordered all the tools and all the chucks and all the wood turning tools. And like I said, I thought I'd
sell. Has that call changed?
No.
I'm holding the call right now, checking it out.
No, I mean the band, I make a style without the band, which is kind of my standard. You know, we fancy them up with the bands, but the call really hasn't changed at all for the last 6 years.
And yeah, you'd call that just like a basic external read.
Yeah,
right?
An external read. It's, you know, it's tuned nasally a little bit, estrusy, you know, which in my opinion in September is kind of the sound I'm going after. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, we talked a little bit before, you know, can we change that sound? And yeah, we can. If somebody prefers a deeper tone or whatever, I can custom cut a read and really dial that into your preference.
Yeah, I've called elk in with that call.
Is that right?
Yeah. I met Jason through Jay Scott and then made a few phone calls and was begged him for a few free calls.
What year was that? Because I remember you having one of these. Yours is the first one I've seen of these, I think.
Yeah. I don't know. It's got to be four or five years ago. Yeah.
So you started turning them on a lathe, the wooden barrel.
Yep.
And you did a lot of extra of, I shouldn't say extra, like, doesn't matter, but a lot of, like, it's an ornate.
Yeah.
It's like an ornate call.
Yeah. I mean, started, you know, got the finish, got the sound, got the size and the shape. You know, some people wanted it to, you know, fit their hand right. Some people, and so I got the sound. To me, the sound is always going to rule a call. So I worked on the sound first and then made them look good second because I knew that was going to, you know, what was going to sell them.
Yeah.
And so I kind of dialed this all in. And in that first year, instead of selling 10, I think I sold 200 or 300. You know, on the local.
Selling them where?
Huntingwashington.com. There's a forum, local, you know.
I know that forum.
Yeah, Huntingwashington.com, and just started putting them. I become a sponsor for dirt cheap prices. Like, they let, you know, level of entry was dirt cheap, like $50 for a year. So I got on, signed on as a sponsor, and just calls just started rolling off.
Really?
And then, like, you know, keep going back to, you know, small country kid. I don't know how websites work. I don't know how e-commerce stores work. I don't know how any of this works. And all of a sudden, like, I'm hit in the face with the, you know, how are you going to keep up? How are you going to, you know, let people get on and buy them? And, you know, and so that's a whole different road. And I'm just a call maker at heart. And so all this other stuff, like, you know, business decisions and stuff sometimes are, I did the best I could.
Yeah. Rip a couple notes on that thing. That's the easy estrus.
Yeah, really. It is really easy to use.
Sounds good.
Man. Really easy to use. I always joke with my old man. He's the only guy on the face of the planet I haven't been able to teach to use this thing.
Oh, really?
It looks like it looks painful. He gets us big, you know, squints his face up. And like, I'm like, no, if you're trying that hard, like, let's start over. But I actually made him a special bite and blower, you know, like the old school.
Oh, just yeah,
bite.
Yeah.
He uses that style.
That's what I started. When I first started messing around, that's what I would have is just the yep. bite and blows because anybody can make a noise. But see, that's the thing is, that's why I always sucked at game calls because I wouldn't work on it at all. So you know, I was brought up, like I hung with a lot of friends, but I mean, I mainly hung with my two brothers and the middle brother, I'm the youngest. The middle brother was just like more of a tinkerer, man. Like he was the kind of guy that would, you know, just totally dismantle electronics and shit. And often leave them dismantled, but he would like dismantle them. Or, and he made a little kit to wrap his own rods, you know? So he'd wrap his own rods and lacquer them. Like just all the painstaking, meticulous hunting and fishing type stuff. And he learned how to do game calls. Not make them, but just learn how to mess with them and, you know, mess with them and tune them. And he was just always like the family caller. And it wasn't until way later. Like, it kind of goes like this. When I was in college, regular school college, you know, they make you take Spanish 3 years, right? I never paid any attention, man. I'd go in there and I'd try to like memorize the shit ahead of time so I could get a grade. The minute I got out of school, I went to Mexico for a month to fish, just camp on the beach and fish. And I'm like, I can't believe I just wasn't paying any attention. The whole time they were trying to teach me Spanish. Because now I'm sitting here looking at these guidebooks trying to figure out how to say basic shit that I know I learned in school and didn't care because it wasn't like real to me at the time. And all those years, you don't have any responsibilities in anything you're supposed to be doing. If I would have just been messing with calls, I missed 10 years of practice.
Yeah. Yeah. No,
Because, like, what else are you going to do? Like, a 10-year-old dude should be messing with game calls.
Yeah, you leave one laying around my house, the kids have got it slobbered up. You know, they sound like a dying rat or a dying cat, whatever they noise they can make. But, yeah, the kids are just
– oh, yeah.
They love those things.
I put it in my kids' mouths all the time now just because, you know, they run around. Everything sounds like a kazoo.
Yeah.
But it's like just getting some basic familiarity with it.
Yeah.
You know? Because, like, but so much of the hunting we did, we were kind of like pre – when I grew up hunting tree stands in Michigan, it was like before people were real serious about the science of whitetail hunting. You know, we do it for ducks. We do a lot of pass shooting, a lot of jump shooting, you know, and you'd see, you'd be out there and just like guns blazing out in the marsh and some guy wailing on a duck call. It's like, dude, it's just like, doesn't matter. You're not going to bring one in with that call.
Yeah.
You know, we're pass shooting out here. So it's just like stuff I just never figured out. And we'd start field hunting for geese and yeah, man, but I was in my 20s before I started realizing what I was missing out on.
Yeah.
You know?
When you moved to Montana, probably, and started hunting elk.
Yeah. Then Then it started messing around with the bite and blow elk call.
Started to matter.
Yeah. I remember calling one of the first times I went out, I remember calling a cow elk in real close. She came in and started blowing at me, like barking at me, you know? And I was like, this is some powerful medicine, man.
Yeah.
These game calls.
But really, elk calling and elk calls aren't that much older than before when you're saying you started doing it, right? When you brought that first bugle tube in 98, I mean, elk calls maybe another 10 years prior to that?
Yeah, I think, you know, I don't know the whole history. I know Larry D. Jones out of Oregon and then Carlton were kind of on that cutting edge of diaphragms and kind of introducing that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, kind of the next historic mark is Rocky Jacobson, you know, developing that pallet plate and then, you know, the whole patent issue with them and Primos, mm-hmm. and then they carried that. And then, realistically, elk calling isn't that old.
Yeah.
Now, my brother, I have an older half brother. I was just talking about my brothers. I have an older half brother, and he guided elk for many years out of Estes Park, Colorado. And I remember it must have been the early 80s. They were messing around with, they were taking diaphragm calls made for turkey. There was no elk one. Yep. Taking diaphragm calls made for turkeys and taking PVC, black plastic, you know?
Yep. Vacuum hoses or anything they can get.
And blowing elk bugles.
Yep.
And back then, hearing about it back then, it just worked, dude. It was it was like the cutting edge, you know?
Yep. Yeah, I mean, my grandpa passed away now, but my grandma, you know, she shows me the old straws, the hard plastic straws that you can kind of coil up. And if you blow through those, you can get that kind of that high pitch. My grandpa used to locate bulls, you know, back with those. And, you know, it's just kind of funny, the progression, you know, anything that these guys could get their hands on to give them the edge. And, you know, and then it went to, you know, going to find your shot back and stealing the hose and chopping it up. And then, you know, we were talking earlier with Giannis, you know, now it's a black plastic bat. You know, people are a lot of guys use those. They just chop them up and drill holes in them and, you know, using them for their bugle tubes.
Yeah. So
the first bull elk I ever, maybe even ever saw, and then proceeded to kill, didn't find him, but killed him. And that bull was bugled in, but he was bugled in with a PVC tube, like a 3-footer.
And no mouth call at all.
No. He had a mouth call,
yeah.
but he blew it through a PVC tube, you know, and that was in 2000, I think.
It's amazing the way the animals adapt, you know, where they hear sounds and sounds get old in their community and then they associate those sounds with man.
Yep.
But you think, like, you got elk turning up, not so much with turkeys, but you got elk turning up that are in their 20s. Dude, that's a lot of experience.
Yeah, a lot of.
Have you found that to be true here in Washington and calling it elk and?
Yeah, I mean, there's a huge difference between calling elk within a mile of a road versus calling elk 15 miles in a you know, walk-in. Mm-hmm. A lot of our industrial timberlands out there are walk-in access only, and, you know, there's a big misnomer that, you know, Roosevelts don't bugle. You hear it from, you know, locals around here or people that have hunted both places. Oh, the Roosevelt bulls don't bugle at all. I'm like, well, if I'd show you my honey hole, I would prove you wrong, or, you know, watch my video that we put together. But, yeah, I mean, Roosevelt bulls, there is a difference in my opinion in herd dynamics. You know, some of those Rocky Mountain bulls have a lot of more mature satellite bulls, you know, that are kind of pestering the herd. And so that does naturally bring out more bugling, but it's not unnormal to go out in the morning here and hear, you know, 10 different bulls in a canyon bugling.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, so.
And you're out in the freak. I mean, you're talking about out in the rainforest,
yeah,
too, man.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Thick, heavy coastal timber.
You're not hearing 3 mile away bulls.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and the same thing, you know, pressured elk, you know, hearing stuff, getting accustomed and learning. I killed a bull in 2011 in a Christmas tree patch. Basically, it replanted probably 10 years. And we'd been hunting this canyon all day, roads around it, you know, bugling from the roads or walking out finger ridges and bugling nothing all day. I sat with that bull, you know, as my buddy went to get help in our bike carts. We were on a bike in area. He was going to push both of our bikes up. And as I sat with that bull, the canyon just lit up. You know, probably by the time we were done, you know, 8 to 10 different bulls in that canyon. We've been bugling and hunting that thing all day, but there's roads around it. But, you know, it is, you know, sun went down and those bulls just lit up. Yeah. And so it's like they've been there the whole stinking day. It's just so much pressure. If they've heard people bugle from every point along that road, they just weren't going to answer anything.
So let's back up, though, because when you started making that, you started making your cow call. Why would people even buy it from you? Like, what would you, because you're just saying, like, yes, I make a call. Yeah. You didn't have any way to share what it sounded like.
No, I mean, we did, you know, a small video production. I was back in 07. We did, me and my buddies, you know, Primetime Outdoors, four of us over the shoulder camera action. So we did have some, you know, video. We went out and did like a 2 minute little, you know, YouTube video of this is what the call sounds like.
Gotcha.
You know, and so that helped a little bit. But I was fortunate enough in 2009 to kill a muzzleloader bull on film, out there in my neck of the woods. And that helped sell the call. And then, you know, it was funny though.
You called that bull in.
Yeah. I actually called him in twice. Called him in, kind of going through the timber. He got to about 40 yards and realized something, and then all the elk were single filing, muzzleloader. I don't know if it was a bad musket cap or what, but pow, drive, you know, just the cap went off and nothing. So he backed out, and I actually called.
He probably didn't like that a whole bunch.
No, they ran around, but we were in a salal patch, just a jungle patch, and we actually went back, ate lunch for 45 minutes, circled the next little finger ridge over, and I called him and another bull back in just using that easy estrus, and I killed the one bull, and you know, so we had that video to share, and you know, it was kind of cool to, you know, call a bull in, scare the heck out of it, and then turn around and call that bull back in.
Yeah, he's kinda thinking like, what are the chances there's two dudes out here?
Yeah,
that's got to be one.
Kind of post ruts, you know, so it worked to help sell the call. And then, you know, not fast forwarding too much, in 2012, I had killed a really big bull here in Washington. And it was funny, I'd already had the diaphragms out. I was tinkering with, you know, kind of completing the line, and then as soon as I killed that bull, it's like, oh, these calls must be even better. You know, it's like, no, they were the same calls before I let that arrow go, and they were the same calls after I let that arrow go. But now all of a sudden, they were better calls. You know, and that was really, and then that was kind of, you know, social media. Kind of, it was all just timing was perfect, and that's kind of helped me, you know, catapult.
So yeah, it was definitely starting out in the elk world.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And you know, whether it's a business decision, whether it was more of my true passion, but you know, some of these other call markets are so flooded. You know, like turkey call. How can I differentiate myself from anybody else in the turkey world? You know, because there's 1,000 turkey or more. There's 1,000 plus turkey call manufacturers. You know, you look at elk and there's 4 or 5, and that's what I was best at. And so I, you know, that was like, let's focus on that, and then we'll expand the predator line and turkey line down the road.
So you never mess around with whitetail stuff then?
No, I've got some, you know, production type stuff. I really get a lot of requests, you know, on this side of the state for blacktail and mule deer calls.
Yeah.
You know, and I was fortunate enough to, do a lot of listening. You know, our state allows bait hunting, and I went over and hunted with my buddy on the east side. And, you know, so we had a lot of we literally sat in a ground blind and didn't have more than 2 minutes without a group of deer in front of us, you know, and bucks running, you know, and running and calling and, you know, coming in and out. We could hear them approaching from behind us and from the side, and really got to take a listen.
And what species?
Mule deer. And I'm like, man, at least the bucks we were listening to were so quiet and deep. I'm like, I'm having a heck of a time replicating that. And
you mean like grunting does?
Yeah. Or grunting bucks chasing does. And like, it's such a deep, sound compared to what you hear all the whitetail calls make. And so I'm like, man, I don't know if I can replicate that. Anyway, I could with the calls that I had, but it was pretty rough.
So do you make a blacktail like a fawn bleat or deer call?
Yeah. That call or the my close read predator is tuned for fawn distress.
Zap that once. Do you do like a bear kind of deal like that? Like the sick of blacktail guys use?
Yeah, similar. It's kind of that.
Yeah.
You know, but this call
is, that brings the does in just stomping mad too.
I've got probably 10 does that are in my yard all year blacktails, and I will when they, you know, here in April or May when they're, you know, June whenever the fawns start dropping, I'll go out and mess with them. I'll go to the corner of my house and blow them. And you have does like literally crisscrossing your yard, running around the corner, and just going nuts.
Yeah, there's a couple calling things that just make you wish that all calls were that way. I think calling javelina. And then blowing one of those at a black-tailed doe.
Yeah.
It's sort of like, you know, even when you stand up, she still is like, okay, I see a dude, but there's a fawn here somewhere in distress.
Yeah. Yeah. I bet you more than 50% of the time, even when I kind of pop out of the corner, she stands there and looks at me and still just stomping and blowing like, I'm a guy, you know, go back to your fawn or whatever. Don't get too, too worked up.
Yeah, we harassed a couple, me and Giannis harassed a couple this fall just kind of watching because like they're so convinced,
yeah.
You know, running down the mountain, you know, snorting at you, stomping their feet, leaving, coming back, you know.
Yeah,
it's just like you feel like you got an animal on a tether, you know, which is not a feeling you get all the time.
Yeah.
Long game calls.
I've watched some hunts up there on, you know, Sitka Blacktail, and during the rut, they'll do it, and the does will come running. Well, a lot of times those bucks are, like, still chasing them, and that looks like a kick.
That's what a buddy of mine says. He thinks that – he's like, when I call a buck in, he's like – they just know they're going toward deer activity. And he was saying, too, that when you get that doe in there stomping around, raising holy hell during the rut, he's like, just hold her there.
No. Bucks will show up.
Because the buck's going to show up because he hears her messing around.
Yep.
You know, he's going to show up.
Yeah.
Now, he's not coming to the rescue. You know, he's not like coming to he's not coming to help a fawn. He's like, something's dying, but there might be a doe over there, too.
Yeah, I'm looking for that doe in heat still. So, no. It's just... You know, the whole game call thing, I don't know if it's a God complex or what, but, you know, being able to have control over nature is always just, I don't know, it's been my passion. Man. Like, man, I'm literally like the steering wheel to this, you know, 1,000-pound bull, you know, elk, or I'm the steering wheel to this, you know, 20-pound black butterball. You know, I'm basically controlling nature at this point, you know, and fooling them. And so that's always been kind of that allure and what's drove me to, you know, develop all these calls and, like, you know, have, whether it's I feel like I have a small part, you know, you get the pictures and it's pretty rewarding to say, hey, you know, your calls were part of this. Even though I say a lot of times, like, it's the carpenter, it's not the hammer. You know, like, don't give me the credit. You're the one running the calls, making the right decisions.
Yeah, exactly,
but it's cool to just feel like you have a little bit of, you know, a part in that success.
When we were down in Bolivia, we were out in the jungle with, you know, just like indigenous South Americans, and they would go and suck on their hand to make a monkey noise. Remember that? They would take a blade of grass to do a tapir whistle. What other kind of stuff they do? They'd make a lot of noises. Like, remember that under that big date tree, he's sucking on his hand, making a little noise. Remember him doing that?
The night I got to go out?
Oh, no. I forgot. Yeah, you weren't there that night. Yeah.
You swapped camera guys every night, so.
Yeah, no, they would go. They're under this tree, and they knew there was monkeys up in the tree. And they were just going, you know. And then later, they were taking grass and making a whistle. And I couldn't ask them, but later I was able to ascertain that there's a tapir will make a whistle like that, you know. So they're just out, like, doing game calls with native materials, you know.
That's awesome.
Yeah, no, it's, you know, people obviously have been doing it for a long, long time, man.
That's like my favorite turkey locator, you know, just the old owl call with your hands, you know. It's just, I don't know, something rewarding about just being able to replicate it with nothing more than your hands, a barred owl call, and get that turkey to snap back. And
yeah,
it's just,
I'm glad you brought that up, because this is something that we've debated and argued about for a long time. I'm curious to get your perspective on it. We'd go out and we'd be like going out in the in the dark, hour and a half before daylight to locate a turkey. And everybody's like, shh, everybody quiet, you know? And someone like slam a car door. It's like, I gave up eventually. I know that like owls and all that, but we would go out and just make noise. Now I take a predator call.
Yep.
And I don't even try to like, I don't be like, yeah, these turkeys are wise, so this needs to sound like something killing a fawn, you know. I just go out and make the most hellacious sound, the most abrupt, hellacious sound I can make on that call to shot gobble. One day I remember we were laying there hunting turkeys and we couldn't find anything. We're, you know, got the peacock thing. It's like, how many turkeys have heard of peacock, right? But they gobble it.
Yep.
We got a peacock thing. We got a coyote thing. All this stuff. Nothing's a gobble. One day my brother Matt just like, hey, at the top of his lungs, stops. Yeah, we go. It's just like, I just don't know if they really like, I don't know if it matters that much.
I don't either.
What you're shocking them up with. And I don't know if they're thinking, when he yells, hey, and he gobbles, I don't think that turkey's then thinking, oh, I better leave now because that was a man.
Yeah. He was just, responding back basically.
Yeah, it's just.
Our experience is all Washington turkey hunting, but there's something to be said for locating at night. You know, we got that, I call it the 30-minute window from about 10 minutes before, you know, dusk and 20 minutes after.
They're going to gobble anything.
Yeah.
If they're going to gobble, that's when they'll do it.
Coyote howl, for some reason, will locate, for us over there, locates everything at night. But then, you know, like you were just saying, we have always been hesitant to use it during the day because now it's like, well, do they want to come run into a coyote? You know, so you're trying to like process this all.
I don't know how much they think about way off sounds. Because I've watched him.
If he was at 75 yards, though, it just happened to be.
A huge, huge difference.
Yeah.
I mean, give him some credit. They don't live that long, you know? Yeah. A 3-year-old turkey is an old turkey. Yeah. Give him some credit. He's definitely watched other turkeys bite the dust at the hands of a coyote. So if you think about how, like, turkeys are born to die, right?
Yep.
75% of nests, roughly 75% of nests that get laid are destroyed before they hatch. 70% of the turkeys that hatch are dead within their first year. 70% of the ones that are not are dead within the next year. 70% of those are dead within the next year. That's why when people find like a big, you know, a 3-year-old bird, it's like, he's a survivor, man. Yeah. You know what I mean? And they'll drop multiple clutches, but I mean, they just die all the time. It's like, just like, turkeys are constantly dying all over the place. You have to think that if you're in an area that has significant numbers of coyotes, that a turkey in his 1 or 2 years on earth is going to be like, that's not a good sound, dude. Yeah. Like, that I can tell you. The dude yelling, I don't know what that is, but that noise I can tell you.
I think he's going to kill me.
Is a coyote.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so I hear all that, and I do like the natural noise because when you're out in the woods, you do want to be discreet, you know? And so running around screaming and blowing, honking car horns, it's just like, it's just an unnecessary thing.
Yep.
Just naturally, I have heard turkeys shot gobble crows in real life, you know? I've heard turkeys shot gobble thunder in real life. I've heard them many times shot gobble red-tailed hawks.
Yep.
Where I see the hawk, hear the turkey,
hear the hawks.
Dogs barking. Coyotes yipping.
Jets flying over.
Have you heard that?
Flock of geese flying over.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of times that jet, you know, you get the whatever that noise that rolls off every once in a while off the jet and bam.
Really?
All right, we didn't have to make a noise. That was easy to get this one started, you know. And
yeah, I just think it's like he's just out there making racket. But yeah, I would never yell. If you yell a turkey 75 yards away and do that, hey, that turkey's going to haul ass out of there. Yep. But the way off noises, I don't know if they're processing it.
I don't think so either. We've always been careful in the morning, you know, because a lot of times we'll locate at night and then try to get where we think, you know, 100 yards within that tree for the morning. You know, if nothing else, it's exciting because it's thinking things going to gobble 50 times in the tree before he flies down.
But, and then he's going to fly down and go off in some other direction.
The opposite
and
direction.
And you kill him at 11.
Yep. Yeah, we'll kill him later. But we usually, you know, that's, our morning's usually silent, just kind of enjoying the sunrise, enjoying all the sounds and
yeah, we used to get out there and think that, you know, like, because everybody's like, yeah, call them off the roost, call them off the roost. No. You know, it'd be like 8:30 in the morning, be like, damn it.
Yeah, flew the other way.
And now I'm like, dude, I would just sleep till now and get up and go get them at 10, 11 in the morning.
I feel like it's taken me 10 years to even realize that now, and maybe people have been saying it and I just wasn't listening, but you should really never call at a turkey that's in a tree. You should never call it one in a tree. You should always let them hit the ground.
Yeah, just wait.
You never. Yeah.
Especially when you hear them up there and you got all these hens going off. Now, I've done it, and I've known people have done it, and I've seen it done, but it's just, yeah, late morning, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, spare it. Like, just don't even mess with them. But your whole life you're brought up, like, you got to be out there hunting at dawn. And it does happen, and it feels good when it happens. But if you're going to give me – if I had to pick 2 hours, if I had to be like, I could only turkey hunt 2 hours a day, I'd hunt from 11 to 1.
Yep. I'd probably pick 10 to noon. Yeah. And some of the best turkey hunters I know, public – you know, not your private land guys, but some of your public land guys here, they won't – they sleep in. They'll eat breakfast in camp, and they don't go – they don't even start their turkey hunt until 9. You know, it's like, let you know, and then just the natural process of the hens going to lay, you know, right, breaking up the flock. It just all makes sense, you know, and I think it's just part of, you know, wanting to be part of that cool experience, the sunrise, and, you know, turkeys gobbling a ton in the tree. I don't know if I necessarily want to miss out on that, but some of these old timers are like, you young bucks can go chase these turkeys around in the morning. I'll go out there at 9 and kill them, or 10 o'clock and kill them.
Yeah, this thing is, you if I hear a gobble in the like pre-dawn darkness, I wouldn't say like, man, we're going to get this turkey. But if you're out and it's like 11, you know, it's kind of sunny out, getting warm, you're getting ready for a nap, and all of a sudden, yeah, we got. You're like, dude, we're going to kill that turkey.
Start the oven.
Yeah, you just know it's like that dude's going to play ball, man. Yeah. You know?
Same with elk, you know, not to switch gears completely, but that's why it's almost a mirror image to me. It's like, man, you get that elk to answer at 10 or 11 or noon in its bed. It's like, That's a killable elk.
No, I know what you're saying. Yeah,
same thing. It's just some reasons, like, this thing's bored in the middle of the day or something. I'll keep them entertained. And we've had great success, turkeys and
getting elk, later in that the morning. I never even thought about it with elk, but I could see, it's like, you know, he's probably more likely to play. He's not just one of a thousand elk all making racket in the first 5 minutes of the daytime.
Yeah, and at 10 a.m., he's probably not traveling like he is at 6 a.m.
Yeah, he's. In my opinion, you know, there's probably people that could, you know, argue, but in my opinion,
everyone's gonna argue.
Yeah, I always, but you know, we've always had great success, or at least have an opportunity if we hear that bull, you know, somewhere between 10 and 1. If he does bugle, we, you know, usually get in close and at least have an opportunity or get to see him or whatever, you know.
So, what was the encounter? Once you got out of doing the asterisk. Not got out, but you made the easy answers. What was the next call you added to your line? Is that when you got into diaphragms?
We bought the presses. We have one press that you know, basically presses down the aluminum frame. We stretch the latex out. It's all on a micrometer, you know, so I can tell within 1/10,000th of an inch.
I don't understand what you mean by presses.
So I'm going to tear this call apart just so you can.
Don't tear that one.
Okay. there's an aluminum frame under here, and it starts out as an oval. It's open. I bend it, and then it crimps it on both sides. So I'll crimp this side first. So this side, and then I'll stretch this side underneath.
You just stretch it by hand?
It's all on a press. It's on a press.
Well, when you're pulling the latex.
Yeah, it's all by feel and by hand, and that's really the art in it. You know, when I first got this thing, I about quit diaphragms. I probably threw 1,000 of them away. Like, I'm never going to get this. And it truly was.
Wow.
Like, there's tricks to it, and I was frustrated. It's like somebody handed me a Rubik's Cube. Like, I'm...
Is that right?
I'm not ever going to get...
Just get the tension right on the latex.
The tension right, or the cuts right, or, you know, there's side tension, there's back tension, there's, you know, tension at 45s. There's all different kinds of stretches you can put into these things, and I couldn't, you know, master... Turkey calls, and I'm going to offend the turkey call makers, are easier to make. The elk calls, there's a lot more, in my opinion, finesse to get these things to react right. So that was my next venture, is, you know, being a die. At this time, I had been hunting archery elk for 8 years and knew, you know, all serious elk hunters want diaphragms. They want to be hands-free. They want to be able to, you know, bugle, cow call, all from the same call. So that was my next, you know, rabbit hole I started running down. And in between, I have, these are all, you know, what I call my medium now, which is what 95% of the guys order, what fit 95% of the guys. But before that, I had a youth and a large. And I knew at the time I was trying to market these things, they weren't the best for everybody, but I was trying to either fit them in one or the other.
Yeah.
And finally, I had, you know, did well enough that I developed my, you know, my own frame, this medium frame. My wife worked for an orthodontist. You know, they make lots of molds of people's mouth. I was like, hey, let's start take some measurements off of inside palates. I want to know.
Oh, yeah.
I want to get this average figured out, you know. And so we kind of, you know, dialed it in there and came up with the size that was going to work.
So what is the average pallet?
We
in Southern Washington.
Is that proprietary?
2 inches. No. It's
don't tell us.
Yeah, no. You no, definitely no. Can't keep
don't tell. Yeah, that's true.
No. Tell you, put me on the spot. I'm like, I. No, it's something easy. Something anybody could buy them and measure them. It's
right.
That's a good idea though, man.
Yeah.
So hit a couple notes on the on your diaphragm.
Okay, this is.
That's a turkey, didn't it?
Yeah. This is my.
Well, you didn't bring any elk ones.
I can use the double. It's not going to sound the greatest. I didn't bring any elk calls up, but this is a pretty tight double. It's similar to. This would be more of a bugle reed. But
so hold on, let me ask this first: is an elk call is the latex tighter or looser than a turkey?
A little bit looser, and usually not as many layers. A lot of turkey calls end up being doubles or triples, just so they can kind of stand that hard cutting. A lot of my elk calls are like one, what I call 1.5 reed or a double reed.
And do you sell more diaphragms or more?
I sell just for pure quantity more diaphragms.
You buy more,
yeah. But of course, the Easy Ester sells really well too, and it's priced a lot higher. So it's all and then Beagle tubes actually. If I could keep the stinking things in stock and the manufacturer can keep up, I probably sell the most Beagle tubes.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and these Easy Esters, as long as you don't lose it, I mean, you could. This thing will work 10 years, right?
Yeah.
Just replace the castration band.
Yeah, I mean, this latex isn't really protected from UV at all, or that latex that's in that castration band.
Castration band, that's what that is.
Yeah, you go to the farm store. I buy tail docking / castration bands, and
you're shitting me. That's what that is.
Yeah, that's a lot of guys will call me up and say, "Hey, will you ship me one? I'll pay for shipping." I was like, "It's cheaper if you got a farm store."
Yeah. Just wrap that around my nuts, man.
I could have brought the tool for you.
No way.
So, yeah, but elk calls are stretched a lot looser. Not quite as much latex in there. A lot easier to blow. And this is a double. It's going to be a little bit hard to control as an elk call, but I could make it work, especially for a bugle.
Nice.
It's not perfect. It's not perfect by any means. My competition calls that I use are all like 1.5 reeds, or if I was out hunting, I would use a 1.5 reed to do all the locating and stuff, and just a lot easier for me to operate. And that feels foreign in my mouth even trying to bugle on it. But
so when you're blowing on diaphragms, what are you mostly doing with your hand?
When I put
let's talk about turkeys first. Like, what are you trying to achieve? Are you trying to achieve that you're sounding like a bird, like a ventriloquist-like thing? Or are you trying to actually affect the sound? So,
yeah, by using your hand, usually to one side or the other, it's causing some sort of deflection off of your hand. That sound's going to hit your hand and bounce back. And so you're really kind of adding a rich tone and some reflection in that call. I was a nerd when I first started this with our cameras, and I would go set up 50 yards away and do it with my hand and without, and with my hand and without, and you could hear a definite difference in the tone by just having
better
your hand
with
up.
The hand, or just different.
Yeah, better. It's just richer. You get some bounce back. You kind of break the call up. If I'm on top of a high ridge, I won't put my hand because I want that. I don't want anything to block that sound if I'm trying to locate. I'll just let it rip and don't use my hand. But typically I don't know why. I don't you just got your hand in there.
But sometimes when I'm watching guys do it, I'm like, that can't all make sense. I feel like it's just like a thing where you feel like you need to be doing something with your hands.
I don't know what to do with my hands. No. Elk calling, especially when I do, cow calls, it's you always got your hand kind of cupped. I ventured down, I had another external elk call for a while called the director, and that call really opened up when I designed it. I didn't realize what my, I designed the tone board and then designed the barrel afterwards to get that right sound. That barrel ended up being less than an inch long, and it absolutely changes the sound whether you put your hand over it and you're leaving it open. If you put your hand over the end of that barrel and blow versus if you leave your hand open like that, if you open your hand up, it completely changed the call and completely changed the characteristics of the call. Not so much with Easy Esters. You can cup it, you can tighten it, it doesn't affect it as much. But on that call, specifically, it made a big difference, by reflecting some of that sound.
So how many different diaphragm elk calls do you make?
Online, I make I usually make 6 different turkey diaphragms. I've kind of
6 turkey diaphragms.
Yeah, I've expanded to 2 more, so I've got 8 total.
Just different cuts or different tensions.
Different cuts, and then on the elk side,
now, when we say cut, like explain what we're talking. Just because I wish that we could. That everybody can see one of these things laying in front of us, but most guys know what a diaphragm call looks like. But explain what do you mean by a cut?
Okay, so on a turkey diaphragm, we've got typically three pieces of latex in order. The top reed's usually the furthest out. The reed under that's set back just a little bit, and then the third reed set back a little bit more. That top reed, we typically put some sort of a cut in it. And what that does is by letting that little bit, since we put the top reed out the farthest, we leave some of that reed hanging over, that second reed. So the second reed's actually your calling reed.
Yep.
And then that top reed's actually introducing some rasp to the call.
Yeah. It's like when he's talking about his cut, it's like you got like a little V-shaped piece of latex, which is just vibrating.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, so
like it's like imagine as you blow air across it, it's like flapping in the wind, but at a very, very high frequency.
Yeah. And we can, I've played with this a ton. However big a chunk, like this is, this is a ghost cut. Industry refers to this as a ghost cut. The center's cut out of it. And, there's all different kinds of cut. The split wire, the split V, is a typical cut. We've got the bat wing cut. Mm-hmm. The split is usually a really raspy call because you have so much material. We didn't take any material out, so you left all of that material overhanging the second reed.
Yeah. Now, what I found, with the cuts, I found that calling turkeys, I can do like a key, stuff like that. I don't want a cut. I don't want a big cut. Yeah. And then for like yelping.
So like certain calls are better.
You mess with it. That's the thing is like everybody's just got to pick them up and mess with them. I don't think you can really anticipate what's going to work for people.
Yeah, and that's the hard part. Some guys come in with what I consider kind of like a shoestring budget. Give me your best 2 calls. I'm like, you just put me in a hard spot, to decide for you because I don't know what's going to be the best 2 calls for you. I can recommend based on what, feedback I've got and stuff.
What do you get for a single diaphragm?
$7 to $8. I'm still fairly low, but I think turkey diaphragms, a 6-pack sells for like $35. So we're under $6 a diaphragm, which is a pretty good deal.
And you make all these?
All of them. I said I can make anywhere from, if they're a single reed elk call, I can make 50 of them an hour. And if some of these triple reeds and stuff, I'm probably at 30 of them an hour.
The whole process?
Yeah. I mean, but it's your efficiency definitely depends on doing one call, the same cut, the same stacking, because I got to lay all these
what
reeds
out. What are you cutting that with?
Just like time flies.
Super, super sharp seamstress scissors, basically.
Oh, so
real
you
small.
Hand cut them.
Everyone's hand cut.
After you stretch it.
Yeah, and some of these, the latex is like a pain. That one you basically cut on the ghost cut. You make the 2 cuts and then you grab that piece of latex and pull it and it rips. Well, you can see sometimes it doesn't rip. And so, this calls the ghost cut specifically, that's my Casper turkey call. It's got like a 20% throwaway because the cut doesn't turn out right. So you make, if I know I have 50 of them to make for an order, I'll make 70 because I know I'm going to ruin 20 of them. And it's kind of part of the deal.
And the larger manufacturers, do they have it figured out where they're doing it completely automated?
No, as far as I understand, there are some big companies that make calls for other companies. Basically, they come up with their specs, and then somebody's sitting there spitting them out all day. But I think there was one of the larger call companies tried to go overseas and basically stretch out 10 yards of latex at a time, and they did, and then have a press come down and hit 200 of them at a time. It didn't work because as everything hit at a different time, you were getting variations in the stretch. And it just didn't work out. I think, to my understanding, everybody that's making diaphragm calls has somebody or a group of somebodies sitting down hand pressing all of these.
So what makes a good one, like with everybody making them, how do you differentiate a good one from a shitty one?
Consistency. In my opinion, anybody can hold me to this, if you buy my Casper turkey call or if you buy my Rip and Red turkey call and you order 100 of them, all 100 of those I expect to be the same. With me making the call, and this is right now I'm able to keep up, but say I'm paying you $15 an hour to sit at a press, I can only make it like 4 hours and my back starts cramping up, my shoulders hurt. Now, say I'm paying you $15, you don't, or if you're getting paid piecework, you don't care if this one's off by 10,000 or you didn't stretch it. You know, you're stamping them and throwing them in the pile because you're getting paid. I'm not saying everybody does that, but I have, you know, control over it. My name's going on the call. I have some pride in this. If I fold a piece of latex or if I miss a crimp or something's wrong, I'll toss it in the garbage. It's not worth it, you know, for me to put my name on that. And that's, there isn't, you know, I'm a call maker and I don't want to discredit other call makers, but really when it boils down to it, it's somebody stretching latex and putting tape on it. It's not rocket science, you know, so to speak. And, that's what, like you said,
there's some art in that there stretch.
There's art in, you know, cause there is no dial indicators on some of these stretches. So it really is by feel, by eyesight.
I was going to ask you about that. Is there anything that you can use to press against that latex to see how much rebound it has or
you could probably come up with a gauge, but then you've got to try to hook like an alligator clip to the back and then somehow, you know, on a fine scale measure the, you know, the poundage or the, you know, whether you probably measure in ounces of pull. I don't even know how you'd measure that. Though we do have a, I have a dial indicator on the one stretch, but it still matters on how much stretch I put on the opposite side. So everything truly is by feel.
I can remember when I was told that when I was having issues with diaphragms, because the same thing, it's like you'd have two or three and you'd be like, man, these things are money. And you'd go buy a couple more and then be like the same call. And the next two would suck, you know? And finally, I talked to somebody and they were like, oh yeah, every year I start off the season with 30 of them and I have five I hunt with. Yeah. The other 25 go into the trash, you know? And so it's cool to hear that you put that much effort into the consistency.
Goal is that when you open up a package, you're not guessing whether it's going to work or not.
Yeah.
You know, like when I went to, I went to Oregon State Elk Calling Championships 3 or 4 weeks ago and it's kind of my little backstory. I blew out. We had the Portland Sportsman's Expo, which is one of the largest sportsman shows west of the Mississippi here down. And I had a booth there and I blew out my competition call. And I, you know, it was almost heartbreaking, like the one I used in Vegas. And now it's gone and I have a competition next week. And, I got down there and, my buddy Corey, who I'd made a bunch of calls for, he was going to buy them from me. He needed some calls for the competition. And I was like, Corey, I need to borrow one of the beasts, which is the name of one of my bugle calls. And, you know, to pull that out of the package and then turn around and use that in the competition is kind of a, you know, my own personal testament.
Oh, is that right? Yeah.
You know, I didn't sit and pick through 100 or 200 of these calls to get the perfect call. I pulled one right out of the package that was an inventory that I would have shipped to anybody. You know, and that's really what I strive for. And a lot of times I'll make 50 to 100 at a time. And if I can't grab 4 or 5 out of there and, you know, they hit the perfect note, you know, I won't necessarily scrap the whole lot, but I'm going to go back through and inspect them. Like, you know, do the cuts look right? Do the stretches look right? And if they don't, I'll toss them and kind of clean that lot up.
Yeah.
And that's, I think that's some of the stuff you don't necessarily get with everybody. And
but don't you wind up hitting a thing where, you know, as you keep doing this and find more success at it, that you're just going to come to a crossroads.
The
man.
Day's coming. It's coming quick.
So then what do you do? Because your kids aren't old enough. Yeah, their name will be on it.
People have told me that women are better call makers on the diaphragm. You know, smaller. I got big old paws. I'm trying to get in these tight little spaces. You know, so train somebody. Do you train family? That's really been my hang up is wanting to give up control of the quality control. You know, the quality assurance and quality control part of the deal. And I don't know what I'm going to do, to be honest. Yeah, because we're running out of time in the days. I need to, you know, steal a line from my good buddy Aaron. Either sleep faster or I need 36-hour days, one or the other.
Yeah. Hit what year did you start doing it, selling turkey calls?
2009.
Oh, okay.
I started kind of development in late 2008, and I think I sold my first one in 9.
What's your first one? What was the cut on your first one?
Turkey calls. That was 2011 when I got the press.
Yeah.
The Rip and Red. They kind of all came together. I developed those 6 kind of originally.
This is the Rip and Red?
Yeah. And it, you know, you basically looked at turkey calls. You know, I didn't reinvent the wheel. I was like, well, what popular cuts are out there? And so I tried to replicate the cuts. You know, I have a Dragon Slayer, one of my elk calls, that's really similar to the Casper we just cut the corners off. And so I kind of knew about where I wanted that thing. So on the Dragon Slayer, we just cut the corners off. So
off the latex.
Yeah, because that adds too much wrath. So on an elk call, I wanted it cleaned up. And so there's tons of playing. And once you learn kind of how the latex reacts and what does what, it kind of, you know, and then I'll come up with a new design and I just kind of slap myself on the side of the head. Why didn't you knew all the components to this call? Why didn't you develop this 3 years ago? It's my new best call or whatever. Yeah.
Now I've had these, cause I hunt a lot, just keep it in my mouth. I mean, I'll try to bite it and have it out of my mouth, but I've had them get wet and fall apart.
Error is there are tape issues and a lot of us get our tapes from the same manufacturers.
Yeah, I'm not saying this didn't happen with a Phelps call, but I mean, I've had it with calls.
It will happen with mine. You know, I try to warranty them. It's not necessarily my fault, but if these things, you know, it's water resistant tape. It's not waterproof.
Yeah, I've learned to be much more careful about just having them be just like slobbered up all the time, man. Yeah.
What's your method for keeping them dry? Or like how much do you run around? If you're just chasing a bull for a day, maybe you haven't heard one for an hour or two, but like through the course of a day, how much does that call in and out of your mouth?
A lot. I used to. Steve's going to play some music.
That's the Raspy Red? Rippin' Red.
I don't want to rip too loud. Get yours out. Answer Yanni's question, but get yours ready.
So on an elk hunt, as much as I need it in my mouth, I will. But as soon as there's a break or we're chasing or we're moving, I have a buddy who, local guy down there just south of me, he had what's called a reed vise, and it's kind of a homebrew little thing. It hooks to my hat, and then it's basically got like an alligator clip that comes off.
That's a good idea.
So the one thing I found this year in Idaho hunting elk, 95 degrees all day, latex doesn't like direct sunlight. So you'd start getting little hairline cracks in your call.
Oh.
I'm like, all right. So then I flipped the underside of my hat when I was kind of blocking my vision. Smart. But
that's where your engineering degree came in.
Yeah,
man.
I was like, I can get rid of the sun. So I use a reed vise, and I have a prototype. Basically like a little coin purse squeezer. But the thing I didn't like with that is a lot of guys were using vinyl and they'd put like a hole punch in it. Well, that wasn't breathing very good. So I used a piece of like 500D Cordura on one side and then like mil spec mesh on the opposite.
Send me one of those.
I'll have to get some made. Trust me, I've got tons of requests. I just, like I was telling you earlier, everything in the U.S. is ordered by the thousands. It's like my initial order was like $20,000 in diaphragm pouches. I'm like, man, how long am I going to have to? But no, I can get some more made. I'll definitely.
So you try to keep it dry.
As dry as
possible.
And
how often are you pulling apart the layers, the latex layers? I mean, is it bad to get in there? I'll like be getting in there all the time and like trying to blow a little air in there.
On turkey calls, especially that top reed, once it gets stuck to that under reed, it's not near as raspy and it kind of locks the call up. So a lot of times in the morning, you got
to
be.
So it is okay just to like do this. Like, I'll do this and get a little.
Here's my advice. Get it wet first. Put it in your mouth for a minute and loosen everything up. Because if you try to pull that when it's dry, a lot of times, especially like on these small little cuts, you'll rip the latex right off because it's stuck pretty good.
I've done that and put it under a faucet too just to
loosen it up.
If you pull one, if you don't clean it and you finish turkey season and throw it in a desk drawer,
it's
pulled out later, dude, it is hard to get them apart. So I'll run it under a faucet and eventually I'll get it where I can.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of stuff. If you have toothpicks around, at the end of the day, you can slide a toothpick in between.
Yep.
Provide,
But it is okay to like,
yeah,
as separate long, them.
Gently separate them. But you can definitely separate them. A lot of times I'll get mad, the Casper or some of, like the Casper, this call that has like really fine ones laying over. When it gets stuck, it just doesn't add any rasp. So it's like, no, I want. So you'll be pulling the call apart in the middle of the morning and
Well, hit a couple notes on your your first one. Sounds good, man.
I'm ready. The wife's ready.
Spring Thunder.
Yeah.
That's
what
out.
I got to do. I got to get the call into my wife. I got to get the call into my wife's mouth because she just is like.
Well, right now they hate it. My wife hates me running around the house blowing game calls. And she's got the kids riled up. They used to like it because she doesn't like it. Now they're like, stop that, Dad. They're like, give me one.
Yeah.
No, they don't like it, but then they want to get one and go make a noise with it.
Oh, yeah. I get My wife's got my kids trained. You go to rip a bugle in the house, and you get three, get out in the garage, is all about in unison.
But she can blow a turkey call, you're saying.
No, she likes to hunt turkeys.
Oh.
So that's my wife's favorite. She likes deer hunting, elk hunting, but turkeys.
You like the rip and red?
I do, but it's weird with the headphones on. I can't tell what it sounds like.
You can't hear what you sound like at all.
Uh-uh.
Sounds good.
You got a nice raspiness. I admire that rasp, man. I don't get it. But you're saying like you visualize.
I don't know if it makes sense. I visualize putting the air towards the end of the reed. Uh-huh. I don't know if it matters or not. Yeah, because here, I'll tell you what. I'll blow towards the back. I'll imagine blowing towards the back, and I'll blow towards the front. Yeah. It didn't matter. That sounds good. Has a lot of rasp.
Yeah.
But what makes me mad is I think I've got this whole like wild hen talk mastered, and you go out and you hear some hen off 100 yards yapping away. I'm like, man, I don't sound anything like her.
No, that's the thing.
That pisses me off.
That happens to me every spring.
I'm like, sounds horrible. I'm
like, you know what that hen sounds like? That hen sounds like a 10-year-old kid with a box call.
Yeah.
Yep, 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 yep. It's like, yeah, everybody in here trying to do all this finesse, and here's some hen up on a ridgetop just laying out. It's like either that's like someone with a rusty box call.
Yeah.
But it's a hen.
Yeah,
a
chocolate box call or something.
Yeah, just up there like the most. Well, the same thing like listening to elk, you know? Like you go out, like there's like the perfect bugle, right? But then you go out and you're watching some bull, and he's basically like, bleh!
Yeah.
There are some nice ones, but you also just hear a lot of
bad.
There's just a lot of variation out there, you know, and you hear some bullies all like hoarse, you know.
Yep. Yeah, or the ones that actually sound like that Primo's Terminator tube, where you think like you'll never hear a bull that will actually sound like fluty like that, yep. But yet he lives out there.
Yeah. Yanni can whistle where it sounds like, you know, like when you can't even tell if you heard a bull or not, it's so far away. Do your whistle.
That wasn't a great one. That was.
Yeah, it's like you're like, God damn, I just heard one way off.
that's my goal every year is to not get called in by somebody. But I think it's screwed up my chances on real elk sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm generally not
that. Generally that, not the other way.
Yeah.
I've had more times where I rode a bull off as being some jackass, and then it turns out to be an elk.
Yep. Yeah, one time we played it all the way through and ended up getting a shot and killed a bull, but I was convinced. I was like, I'm not taking one more step because I'm not getting called in by somebody.
Yeah.
He's like, it's a real bull. I'm like, no, it's not. Listen, it's horrible. And he was back 15 yards to my left but could see over the ridge better, and he's like, here they come. I'm like, son of a gun. You know, I'm glad we stayed, but if I was here by myself, I would have went the other way. Like, I'm not, or mess with somebody. I like to call people at the top of mountains and stuff, mess with them. But
I walked right to a couple one time. We were actually walking off the mountain. We'd been in there for, I don't know, maybe 3-4 days. I think it was my dad, and the only time he went in the backcountry. But we could hear him calling, and I was, you know, just 100% sure that I think he might have even been running the Hoochie Mama, which that call, you can definitely pick it out, you know? And so I just figured, well, I'm just going to just tromp down right through the forest, just right at them, which in retrospect probably wasn't the smartest thing to do, because I come through like the last two Christmas trees, and like 6 feet away, there's a girl standing there with an arrow knocked, not drawn, thank goodness.
Oh, really?
But knocked, and just, I can see the top limb just is like boom, 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 just shaking, you know, and her I don't know if it's her boyfriend or husband behind her is like kind of smiling over her shoulder. He must have, you know, known that, you know, I was coming, or he caught a glimpse of me. But, you know, in retrospect, it's probably not the best thing to do, just gonna charging in on something.
Totally the best thing to do. What was the response like when you started selling turkey calls? Like, do you sell turkey calls to the guys in the East, or is it all west?
No, it's pretty localized. My turkey, a lot of it stems from guys I've sold elk calls to. You know, it's kind of that.
Because you're saying the turkey call market's so
saturated. And, you know, you got the big companies back East, you know, there's just a lot of turkey call manufacturers back East. And it's just.
So there are guys making turkey calls, big companies that make turkey calls that aren't making elk calls.
Yeah, correct. A lot of, you know, a lot of those companies back East are, you know, maybe waterfowl turkey, maybe, you know, squirrel, you know, squeal, you know, there's some different mix. But if for some reason a lot of these call manufacturers have stayed away from elk, it seems like a lot of your manufacturers besides Primos, you know, like Hunter Specialties and Night and Hail have dabbled in it. Woods Wise, some of these companies have dabbled in elk calls, but they don't have a huge presence out here. Where, you know, out west, we've got primos from back east, but you've got Rocky Mountain game calls or bugling bull, whatever you want to call them. You got Barry game calls. You've got Point Blank, which used to be the old Larry D. Jones. And it seems like out west there's a lot fewer elk call manufacturers.
Do you make a dusky grouse call?
I don't.
Did you watch our episodes about dusky grouse?
I didn't.
Man.
See,
you'll sell 5-6 of those every decade.
See, you guys are intriguing because I hear about all the stuff you hunt, and it's like I'm literally a mule deer, blacktail, and an elk hunter. That's I cut my teeth on that, and it's just I've got an opportunity. I can hunt those every year. I've always got the moose, caribou, sheep stuff on the radar, but that's going to be a lot harder to make.
So
happen.
You haven't dabbled in making a nice cow call for
no.
moose?
No. Yeah. No, we haven't played around. I've made some.
The market's limited on that because so many guys that like to hunt moose just learn how to do it.
Yeah, with their voice.
But I'm telling you, man, a dusky grouse call for guys that like to hunt spring hooters, you'd be the only guy in the market. Yeah. But it's a tough call.
That's what everybody tells me.
Male call is easy because you do that with like a jug or something, But the female call, you figure that one out.
I get a lot of requests for antelope calls. I'm like, I'll just get you like two. I don't know what this. I always joke with them because I don't know what antelope.
They do like a.
Yeah. I just figured I was going to get like two glasses of water pouring back and forth and then just let the antelope hear the water and that'll call them in, right?
Yeah, they do make a noise. They make a noise and it's, they use it, and you can make it back at them and get a good response out of them. It's just like, the closest thing you compare it to, it doesn't really compare, but like a whitetail's warning call,
When they blow.
Yeah, they just got like a, here's a whitetail, like, whoosh, right? And the antelope's like, but they, like when a whitetail does it, the whitetail doesn't give a shit about hearing it back, Yeah. Like no matter, it's never gonna come. They're not gonna come check the noise out. Antelope are intrigued by that noise.
They'll come back.
Like you can hold their attention with the noise.
So you're saying no to all that stuff, but is there like the next rabbit hole for Phelps game calls? Like, is there a challenge, like a call that you've been wanting to make or trying to make that you just haven't figured out yet?
I ultimately blacktail. I want to make a blacktail grunt. It seems to be real popular.
Blacktail grunt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's highly requested. Mule deer grunt. The late season bow hunters have.
Who's using mule deer grunts? Bow hunters.
Yeah. A lot of late season bow hunters think that they potentially, when they get in close, it could be. They wouldn't use it all the time, but a lot of the guys say it could be a game changer or it could work occasionally. And
I wonder if if a mule deer is going to act any different when he hears a whitetail. Does he give a shit?
I don't.
If he hears a whitetail grunt?
I don't know. I've never. That's one of the things I'm not real versed on. I'd probably call in some people that have messed with
it. It's like it's shorter.
Yeah, it's shorter and it's deeper and it's quieter from what I've heard. But I don't do a whole lot of late season archery deer. Last year was the first year I've ever bow hunted for a late mule deer, and what I heard wasn't what I thought I was going to hear a mule deer grunt sound like. So I was like, all right, go back to the drawing board, change up the reed thickness and change up the barrel diameter and making some changes. So,
but you never feel like messing with waterfowl?
I will eventually. If I want to make a run at this thing full time, I'm probably going to have to develop the waterfowl line. But I don't – this is the other thing. Some guys may go reproduce a call that's out there. I'll probably bring in 4 or 5 guys because I'm not a waterfowl expert. I don't claim to be a duck hunter. The waterfowl calls I sell now are basically Echo inserts. You can buy them right off their website from Echo, and I basically just am a wood turner. I can turn the barrel. I had my buddy come over and size the barrel for what he liked, and that's what I sell. I don't have a whole lot of investment or my skill doesn't really come into play. My buddy basically sized it for me. But I probably imagine, the predator call line is decent. We got 1 closed reed and 3 open reeds. Probably waterfowl's next.
Did you bring one?
The closed reed. It'll do the fall and distress and also does that real raspy jack once you break the reed over. Really loud.
Oh, like
obnoxious.
Just by give force
of
air.
Yeah. So, you got that real quiet fall and distress and then you can crank it over and.
Yeah, get like the holy smokes noise. Yeah. So, you're making turkey, elk, predator.
Yep.
Right now,
waterfall or a little bit, a couple duck calls.
Yeah.
Yeah, which, like I said, just a wood turner on the waterfowl.
But if you had to make just one, you're like, you do elk.
Elk is, you know, elk.
That's what your passion
elk
is.
Elk followed by turkey, followed by predator, probably in that order.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely, you know, passion, most passionate about it. That's where, if I try to line all my vacation up, it's like elk, elk, and then maybe a mule deer hunt on the end. You know, it's like I want to be elk hunting at least 2 weeks a year and in the rut.
How many elk trips do you do every year?
Last year was one, but I did it 2 weeks continuous. So, like, you know, weekends included, we were gone like 19 days. This year, got a new job. So it's like two, you know, a 9 day trip, come back for a week, and then a 9 day trip. So I'll try to hit, you know, I'll try to be in the elk woods anywhere from 15 to 20 days in a September.
You're calling it elk every day, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah. Usually we're pretty
close. And then you hunt here with your rifle.
Yeah. Or I'm actually putting in for East Side special permits now. So typically I don't hunt Washington if I don't draw. Yeah, we go out of state and do all of our elk hunting currently. You know, the wife still hunts around here, so I get to go out, or the rest of my dad and his family, so I still get to do a lot of, you know, riding along and hunting along and spotting and stuff.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
The life of a custom call maker.
Oh, it's exciting. It's exciting.
So is your home shop just given over entirely to...
Yeah, I got a... basically built rooms within my shop because the dust was uncontrollable. You know, I'm still just in
the dust from turning the
wave. Yeah, the dust and sand, and it was getting everywhere. So we like enclosed the section of the wood shop, and then we've got like our inventory and, you know, a different section. And then, you know, I'm still just working out of the shop basically. So the lawnmower is parked on the other side. You know, it's not just a game call shop. So,
and do you have a distributor, or are you shipping all yourself?
We do everything direct. You know, probably 80% of the sales come directly through my website, and then I've got
people don't buy you off Amazon.
No, I've been approached.
If you want to buy a Phelps, you go to Phelps.
Yeah, right now we have four or five dealers, local bow shops that I'm just buddies with or buddy deals, and then we do have one other online retailer. It used to be Elk 101, but now it's Black Ovis is selling the calls out of Utah as well. So a couple online it's funny, you know, it's. You debate business models, you know, and I understand you want pro shop support, right? You want, you know, you want that guy to sell, you know, the guy that comes and buys a bow, your call. If you take that away from him, you may lose that support. And since he's got a, you know, a bugling bull or a berry reed on the shelf, he's going to sell him that because that's where he makes his money. So there's a balance. You know, I like the whole QU model. You know, as a business owner, I like that model, but at the same time, I understand it's not the best model necessarily for the business I'm in. So, like I said, I never claim to be a smart businessman, but some of this stuff is the stuff I'm weighing right now. Like, what direction do we go, and what's the best direction? And so like,
you're seeing growth every year, though.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah, exponential growth every year. I don't know where it's going to stop, but like, same conversation. You start talking about that, and you come back full circle to how you're going to keep up. Because I don't know what I'm going to be able to do in July and August. That's my two by far biggest months because, you know, centered around everybody buying their elk calls.
Dude's gearing up for elk season.
It's going to be interesting this year.
Yeah.
The wife said I had one more year to do this all on my own. Then I better figure out a streamlined way.
Was that right?
Well, it was rough last year. You know, basically every weekend, you know, all weeknights till midnight. Get up at 5, go to work, get home at 5:30, and you're making calls until midnight. And
well, now you're just a couple hours south of Steve. You can probably just call him up. You can come down. And
stretch a little latex. I stretch a little latex my day.
Bet you never heard that one before.
So now, what? You got a website, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah, we're PhelpsGameCalls.com.
PH.
PH. ELPS.
You know the NATO phonetic alphabet?
Which
is like Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, Delta.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's supposed to be that all the NATO countries, that they would look at those words and pronounce and know how to pronounce those words. You know, I'm working on the confusing phonetic alphabet where I'm trying to find all like for P would be pneumatic. Or for P you could do psychology or gnomic. For, you know, so all words that don't start. I'm just bringing this up to point out that your name is not F-E-L-P-S.
Correct.
For phone, P-H. Phelps. P-H-E-L-P-S. And what's the website, though?
PhelpsGameCalls.com.
PhelpsGameCalls.com.
And people just usually just order online.
Yeah, you know, I'm pretty open on social media. You know, a lot of times, and you know, that's maybe the difference. You get the experience with me. A lot of times, I'll get we'll message back and forth, banner it, you know, back and forth at 8 o'clock at night. You know, what do I need to order? This is what I would order. What do you do? And then all of a sudden, you see the order pop through.
So you have dudes call up and be like, "Hey, looking for advice on what to get."
Yeah, or a lot of times, like, you know, maybe it's a new era, but I don't know if it's tacky or untactful, but a lot of times with my phone now, it's easier to do a text message or a Facebook message. That's how I communicate, and it makes it super streamlined, so I can deal with a lot more customers that way. You know, so a lot of guys will just, you know, hit me up on Facebook and message me or text me right off the website, and then it just makes it quick and easy.
And then they place the order.
Yeah, like instantly, I was just talking to, you know, Rob so and so, and then bam, on my phone I see the order come through.
Oh yeah.
You know, so it's pretty cool.
Yeah, and you got concluding thoughts?
They're beautiful calls, man.
Thanks.
Impressive.
You can rip a couple notes on there.
Let's hear Jackrabbit Distress.
I'm no good at that. I can run the Easy Estrus. You can run the Jackrabbit. Steve likes to blow those at grizzly bears usually when we see them.
I think I've seen you guys running from a grizzly bear in one of the episodes.
Yeah, I do like to blow them at grizzly bears. It annoys people I'm with.
Makes
I'm always
all,
like,
makes
I'm always like,
easy.
Hey, let's see if this bear will check this out.
Yeah. We're only camped a couple hundred yards away. Let's see if we can bring this grizzly bear closer.
So you just don't have any fear of them, or like, it's not a lack of respect, but just no fear?
I used to be real. No, not real. Yeah, it's just to me, it's like a...
What happened?
You know, some dudes drive fast down the highway, right?
Yeah.
I don't like that. I like to drive slow down the highway. Like, I have that, right? I have that thing. I just don't have the bear thing.
I'm the same way
some guys can drive 100 miles an hour, right, weaving in and out of... I can't do that. Yeah. But those guys might be scared of bears. I'm just not afraid of bears. I mean, I'm afraid... Like, I respect them, but I don't... When I see a bear, the first thing I'm not... The first thing on my mind isn't that he's going to come scratch me up.
So you're not reaching for bear spray or your gun or anything? Or
no, I'm just like, wow, hey, a bear.
I always felt like somebody's going to pull my man card because, like, the whole eastern Idaho, southwestern Montana, northeastern Wyoming, like, I went deer hunting in Region F in Wyoming, you know, against that eastern border. We seen, like, five... The day after I killed my buck, there was grizzly bears everywhere. I'm like, this isn't my thing at all.
I like that. I honestly like... If I could have absolutely identical, right... places, everything exactly the same, and they're like, only difference is this one's got grizzlies and this one don't, I'd be like, let's go hunt the grizzly one, just because I like looking at them.
They're cool from a distance. I like looking at them from like 800 yards away in the spot and scope.
If we had more time to talk about it, I would talk about the current debate around delisting in those areas you named, and I've looked at it from all angles. I think it's the best way forward for the bears and for people is delisting. You know, I think I got to delist them off the endangered species list. There's a lot of bears in those areas. They met the requirements. You can't tell states and all these people, you can't tell them for decades that here's what recovery looks like and we're all going to strive for recovery and make all kinds of sacrifices and achieve the goal and then move the...
Moving target.
And then move the marker on people, man. It's just like, it just makes people so resentful of the Endangered Species Act when, in fact, it's a great tool that works well, but you got to put shit on and take it off.
Yep. Like
we don't
intended to do.
It's a one-way street, man. Stuff gets on, it never comes off, especially if it's charismatic.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. We don't got enough time, but that's a whole same thing. Like this state and the wolves, I don't know if you've looked into much.
Yeah.
This state's recovery, the wolf recovery plan is absurd compared to the public ground we got versus the number of breeding pairs we have to have plus the 3-year wait time. It's like, why are our objectives in this state so much higher than these other western states that have way more public ground and way more, you know.
And even when they do hit it, someone's going to block it because it's charismatic.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, yeah, turn it over. Then they act as though turning it over to state management is some outrageous idea. And you want to be like, well, hold on a minute. Every other animal is state management. So Montana is managing, 7-8 big game animals, all fur-bearing animals. They're managing everything. People go like, oh, yeah, just turn it over to state management.
That's absurd. It's like, but they manage all the game. They manage all the large carnivores. They're managing black bears. They're managing mountain lions. They're on and off managing wolves, managing coyotes, managing bobcats. It's not like they don't have a grip on... Oh, it's frustrating.
Oh, yeah.
I don't mean to take us away from game calls. What was your concluding thought? That you like the looks of the call, Yanni? That's the best, that's as much as you got?
No. I didn't. No. Now you got me thinking about, management.
He's mad.
Yeah, let's not get into that conversation right now.
No, but it's really something that I think people need to learn more about.
They do, because I really try to read both sides, now just like, there's been just so much written out there lately about like the grizzly delisting, and it really seems like at least everything that I've read so far, and it's been probably a half dozen articles like against the delisting. It's very unfounded and just kind of fanning the flames type of rhetoric where they're not really just laying out the facts. They're like, the only thing that's going to come from this delisting is basically uncontrolled trophy hunting.
Yeah.
And you're like, whoa, no, that's not how it works, bro. Like what you just said is completely a lie. But yet, because of the magazine you published that in, million people just read that.
Yeah, the most irresponsible one I've read was in a thing called a publication, Daily Beast.
Mm-hmm.
Have you read that one? I was surprised the guy that wrote that even keeps his job, because he says in there that there's no money, that a state doesn't have money to manage. And again, you point out how many they manage all the animals, right?
Yeah.
That they have no way of knowing how many get killed, which is absurd because you know how many tags you issue. It's like they know how many deer they're killing, states killing thousands and thousands of deer. They know how many deer they kill through how many tags you issue. You do surveys. You do mandatory surveys. You have quota systems that are in place. It's fine-tuned. So he's like, they have no way of knowing how many. Like, that's absurd because they track all that stuff.
Yeah.
They know how many ducks
there would be they no ducks more of a controlled hunt in our country than if there were to be a grizzly bear hunt.
And the other point that they miss is all of these individuals and game agencies and conservation groups who've worked so hard to get wolves and now grizzlies off the list. Don't you think that after you work that hard to get them delisted, the last thing you're going to want is to have them back on the list? Whose interest would be being served if you hand it over to state management, that the state would shoot them all out so they get put back on the list again? Who's motivated to do that? You spent 40 years basically trying to recover the thing and then act like you're going to blithely go out and shoot them all down so they get put back on the list for another 40 years. And like, that's the motivation? Duh.
Make any sense.
So anyways, you like the looks of that game call, Yanni.
I do. I'm fired up to go turkey hunting. I'm stoked.
Dude, I'm so excited about turkey hunting. So will you hunt turkeys besides Washington this year?
I it's one of those, you started off with the whole why
don't
do people,
even hit me with the how you don't like turkeys.
No, I love turkeys. It's just one of those things where I won't, we've got
you three, don't travel for
we
it.
Have three species right here, and we've got Easterns on the west side. We've got, Merriam's down in the south central. We've got Rio's down in the southeast, and we've got kind of a Merriam Rio mixed up in that northeast corner. We've got a ton of opportunity right here close. So I typically don't travel more than 4 or 5 hours across the state to turkey hunt.
Yeah, but you do good.
Yeah, we've did really well, really well.
You got concluding thoughts? That's where you get a chance to say anything lasting on your mind. You can
reiterate. I'll go first with mine.
But you already had your chance. You said that you liked the call, and then you read some articles.
I'm going to conclude with I'm going to get Annie Racer out and change your mind. Because I think I've got Brittany Brothers coming along with us. I have like a twofold plan. Because for me to hunt with my wife, someone's got to stay in camp to tend to kids. So she's going to come along to fill that void. I'm going to also take her out turkey hunting a little bit. And then we'll coerce Annie to come along with us. And she'll be, next time she's on the podcast, she'll be here.
So you have a whole pack of ladies down there hunting turkeys. Good. Are they calling? Are you teaching them to call?
I haven't yet, but we've been talking. We need to do all that very soon. Go pattern shotguns and get them calling a little bit.
Yeah.
Jason, concluding thoughts?
Let me go out in left field here. You know, I'm excited just to kind of see where this whole thing goes. And ultimately, you know, I've been blessed with the position to you know, maybe not reach as many people as you, but I feel blessed. I get the chance to discuss and talk with a lot of people and influence a lot of people through this game call avenue. And ultimately, you know, just trying to keep the eye on the prize. I'm always thinking about my kids and my kids' kids, and you know, trying to leave this place. And if I can influence or impact anybody from my position, you know, make sure we leave this place a better place for all of our kids to hunt.
Yeah,
and have the opportunity, especially on the political front. That's where it's never going to go away. I don't see it getting any better. So
keep at it.
Stay united. You know, it's like I get so tired of hearing the archery hunters argue with the muzzleloader hunters, argue with the rifle hunters, and then, you know, hitting each other, you know, pulling knives out of each other's backs, trying to, you know, it's like, it's just, I always feel like we should, you know, focus our efforts elsewhere and you know, stand united. But
instead of arguing about whether it's better to do with a bow or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, like I said, I kind of went out in left field, but that's kind of.
That's a good closing thought.
That's a closing thought you're for. My closing thought is a thing I've always liked about the world of hunting and the world of fishing is how it really invites so many people just to be inventive and to like just make stuff. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Like even growing up, like I grew up around old guys and they'd like make their own bucket scalers and guys would make their own rods and tie their own stuff and you kind of get good at it and get a knack for it. And pretty soon you're selling a couple things. It's just like this funny little, it's just like such a great economy of entrepreneurs and, you know, just kind of like American elbow grease, man. You know, like just people getting in there and making stuff. And it kind of comes from people who are out in the woods and on the water all the time. And they're messing around with their gear and they're like, man, this, you know, if I made this, I'd make it this way, or I'd make it a little bit better. And just like that constant cycle of invention and doing stuff. It's just fun that the way hunting and fishing really invite people to get in there and be craftsmen.
Yeah.
You know, because there's a lot of stuff in your house that just like things you might do in your world where you just don't have the garage tinkerers, you know, like you do in this world, man. It's funny. It's you imagine in the old days, people would just sit around and everybody would nap their own arrowheads, you know?
Yep.
And it's kind of like that to see people out there just like making hunting gear, you know, trying to do something a little bit better. And you can just get in there and do it on your own. And in your case, get in there and do it and make a business out of it.
Yeah.
It's fun, man. It's a fun world. So yeah, good luck to good luck to you making the calls.
Yeah, thanks.
It was cool to get a chance to meet because I've been wailing on some of these calls for a couple of years now, but never got a chance to talk with you. So
yeah, we'll get you loaded up before you head to Mexico.
All right.
So thanks for having me.
Yep. Thanks for listening, everyone. Take care.